Look at my prediction. I'm predicting this is going to happen, and you can't see this coming, but I can. And the reason I could see it coming is because I studied this field of persuasion, and I saw this Trump character, and he had the full tool set.
Thank you for coming out. That's one anniversary, Reason's 50th. Thank you for celebrating. This is our first big event of our birthday year. The other anniversary, and this brings us to Scott Adams and his book, is the first anniversary of Donald Trump as president. You know, and I think we're probably of mixed minds about that, Scott. And by that, I mean we dislike him or we dislike him more, but maybe not. And Scott is certainly of that. Scott's book, Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter, is built around his bold prediction back in 2016, or what did you actually?
15.
Yeah, in 2015, that Donald Trump was going to win. And at that point, he was seen as a madman, a crazy person, a writer of doodles that have fired our imagination for, you know, more than 25 years, but not more than that. And now you sit here with a book, which is obviously going to be a bestseller. And I think you've persuaded a lot. You've won before anybody even reads the book in terms of persuading them that you know what you're talking about because you were there alone. We're going to talk about his unique take on Donald Trump, as well as his contention that he repeats again and again in the book, which is one I've learned from reading the book is one form of persuasion to repeat things over and over again. But that, quote, facts don't matter. And again, this is a tough sell in a Reason room. His book isn't simply about Donald Trump and contemporary politics. It represents, in many ways, a direct challenge to the world that Reason and most libertarians inhabit or want to inhabit, one where logic and rationality are not merely possible, but preferable. Before we start our conversation, I want to give a quick sketch of Scott's background. He was born in 1957, raised and educated in upstate New York. Shortly after graduating college in 1979, he did what everybody with half a brain in upstate New York did in 1979, which was fly to California. And I guess you haven't taken. Have you ever been back?
Not in the winter.
Okay. Which means you could only be there about 3 months out of the year, right? So, and he started years of working at the kinds of jobs that he talks about or makes fun of and lampoons and satirizes in Dilbert. He started at a Crocker National Bank, and I learned earlier tonight in an off-the-record conversation, but fuck it, I'm going to say it, as a bank teller, as well as working at Pacific Bell. He picked up an MBA at UC Berkeley along the way and then launched Dilbert in 1989. The rest is history, of course. Dilbert helped to define the 1990s, and none of us felt quite as alone or unappreciated in our cubicles ever since. And we knew we had somebody who understood what was wrong with our managers, even when we were those managers. Since then, he's published numerous collections, nonfiction books, has won basically every award that you can for cartooning. He's also a trained hypnotist, so, you know, don't stare into his eyes too long. And he is a student of persuasion, which is precisely why he says he was able to call Trump's victory long before it seemed credible to almost everybody, particularly people like me, political journalists, you know, who really virtually no one saw it coming. I think you talk in the book about how Nate Silver, the blogger who made his bones by calling, I guess it was the 2012 election, he called every race right, every congressional race right. He had Hillary Clinton winning with a 98% accuracy or certitude. Scott took the 2% and turned it into a victory. So, Scott, thanks for talking to us. Now we are here.
Pleasure.
Now, let's start by talking about your worldview. You describe yourself, you're not a conservative. You are a liberal. You are actually very liberal.
Extreme liberal.
Extreme ultra liberal. You're taking liberalism to the extreme. How do you define, like, what do you mean by that?
The only way to describe it is with some examples. So, for example, abortion. Conservatives would like to limit it. Liberals would generally like to make it available under certain conditions.
And they want to expand it, right?
Expand it.
Okay.
And I'm even left of that, where I say that women should decide and that men should follow their lead based on the following logic. That men don't add anything in terms of knowledge, but they certainly don't have the same skin in the game, the same experience, the, you know, the lived experience. And even if you're not going to have a baby or get pregnant, you're still in the workforce and the expectations are on you, et cetera. So the most credible kind of a law when you've got a life and death situation is the one that society will look at and say, all right, even if I don't agree with that law, that's credible the way it was made. And if women collectively decide whatever they decide, I'm going to back them. Now, of course, I'll decide on my own money and taxes and stuff, but that's but, just
well,
what
so what else? How, I mean, so you're liberal on abortion or extreme liberal on abortion. What else? Or I suspect, and again, I don't want to speak for the people in this in the room, but, you know, libertarians are like, okay, yeah, we're pro-choice, or we're certainly pro getting the government out of people's personal lives. So, anger us right now.
Glad to help. For example, I have an idea for slavery reparations. That's about as left as you can get. And the idea would be to, for 25 years, to give free college to any African American who, you know, is below some income level, so it's reasonably fair. And then after 25 years, say, all right, we're even, basically. Now, this is...
You haven't been to college lately, have you? I mean, that might start another reparations round. Because it's like,
and so the idea is that you would tax only the top 1% to fund this, because the top 1% always gains whenever society gains. You know, if society gains $2, the top 1% gets 10 of it, you know?
Yeah.
So if you help the people in the deepest hole, you get the biggest bang for the buck for the people at the top. It's essentially self-funding in the long run.
So, I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to have Scott talk about his political worldview or his ideology up front is that over the time that he was blogging about Trump and about Trump's likely victory, people were accusing him of being a Trump supporter in a kind of basic way, of that he wanted to advance Donald Trump's agenda as opposed to observing it. So, I mean, that's part of it. I want to give you some separation from the guy you're talking about. And it's really about the process, which comes through very well in Win Bigly. Now, you write on page 37 that the main theme of this book is that humans are not rational. I was expecting a... so now it hurts.
I think we're done.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it hurts to hear that, because the first issue of Reason 50 years ago promised the readers that we will trade in, quote, logic, not legends, and, quote, coherence, not contradictions. So what's the evidence that humans are not rational or swayed by facts and argumentation?
Well, I'll tell you how I came to it, and then I'll give you the scientific part of it. When I studied to be a hypnotist, and this was early 80s, I guess, one of the things you have to understand in order to be a hypnotist is that people are irrational 90% of the time, but they don't know it. You know, we do have the capacity to be rational, but only on stuff we don't care about. All right. So, you know, it was a rational process for me to figure out how to get from my house to here. Right. I had several ways to do it. All rational. But if you had added just a little bit of emotion to that, ration just goes out the window. And you can't even be a hypnotist until you understand people as fundamentally irrational. Now, since then, there's a huge body of evidence. If you read books like Influence by Robert Cialdini, Thinking Fast and Slow. There's a book called Habit. There's now all kinds of science that gets at the same point from different directions, that we think we're rational, but it turns out Facebook can change your vote, you know, and you don't even know why. You just know you were looking at, you know, postings of your family, and suddenly you like that other candidate a little bit better. So at this point, it's no longer... sort of the intuitive feeling that old hypnotists had. It was just sort of their lived experience. is now backed by science. And you can see in the Trump phenomenon, you know people who have high IQs who completely disagree with you, right? Now, in the old days, I used to say, well, one of them is wrong. Like, there's a right one and there's a wrong one. And I was always quite lucky because I was always the right one. Like, no matter what situation, I was always the right one. And then I realized everybody thinks that about themselves. And so it turns out that a clearer picture of our human existence is that we are rationalizing, we are not rational, and that we're indeed creating what I call a movie in our head to explain the facts. But here's the interesting thing. We can look at the same facts and support two completely different movies. You see that, and maybe you'll be asking me about this, but in the Trump phenomenon, we're all looking at the same news for the most part. You know, they're little silos, but the big stuff is all the same. And the Trump supporters are saying, well, look what he's done to the economy. And the anti-Trumpers are saying, you mean Obama's economy? There's just nothing that can't be seen through both movies. And only rarely do they conflict to the point where you just have to solve one of them. And from that point on, both movies can see the same fact.
So if we are not rational, where do our how do decisions get made via emotion? Or what goes into that? So, certainly with Trump, he has the worst approval ratings. He had the worst approval ratings of any modern political or presidential candidate. Hillary was second worst. But where do those perceptions come from if they're emotionally driven?
Well, let's talk about approval ratings. I don't think they mean what they used to mean. When I was younger, I remember the talk in politics was, there's not a dime of difference between the Democrats and the Republican. So in that world, if you supported one of them but the other one got elected, you could say, well, I'm warming up to that other one. They weren't that different from the start. But now you have Donald Trump. He's just not like anything else, right? So if you didn't like him, it's this huge mental leap you would have to support him. So instead, because your worldview got upset when he won, most of the world believed it was literally just impossible he could win. And that was, of course, reinforced by the news. They said the same thing right up until Election Day, well, halfway through Election Day, right? So this is the perfect setup for something called cognitive dissonance. Now, cognitive dissonance is that moment when the thing you know to be true is clearly and unambiguously not true. And instead of saying, oh, I guess I learned something today, I'm a big fucking idiot, right? Sorry. But people don't do that. They say, oh, I guess the Russians got him in, right? So you need to have a reason why you were always logical and you were, well, even if you weren't exactly right, you were pretty right. And we're all doing that all the time, but only for the emotional questions, and politics is clearly in that. Look at marriage, for example.
I suspect when you say that, you mean let's look at divorce.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Half of them don't work, and of the half that apparently work, well, maybe half of them are as happy as they should be. And the ones that are happy, and we'll stick to that story, or maybe a little cognitive dissonance explaining, why did I do this crazy thing? It's not making me happy. Oh, I guess I am happy. So science has much support for this idea that we rationalize quite easily.
Right. Speaking of happiness, you talk about how we use filters to engage the world. I mean, that's the screen kind of through which we see the world. And you say that good filters are ones that make us happy and predict events correctly. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah. So once you, I have to give you a little bit more background. When I first came to San Francisco, my girlfriend at the time talked me into taking mushrooms. And I got...
Was that a tough sell? I'm betting it wasn't that tough.
No, it was. It's the one and only time I've ever done that. And you experience a reality that where all the stuff you understand, like you know what this is and you know what it does and how to lift it and everything else, but you're seeing it like you're an alien who came to the planet and had never seen these things, but you just knew about them. So everything looked new and different, but everything worked. And that this was the big aha, that you can see things through a completely different filter, a different movie, if you will, and you can still get to work. You can still eat. You still do all your stuff. But that plus hypnosis plus, you know, a lot of reading on persuasion taught me that if I say that my version of reality is true, I'm probably an idiot. Probably an idiot. The best you can say is that you've got a filter on reality that either does a good job of predicting and making you happy or it doesn't. That's as good as you can do. So when I started talking about Trump and the election, I said, watch this. I'm going to predict what happens in a very unlikely situation. So I told people from the start, don't ask me later how I got it right, because everybody can rationalize the past. Look at my prediction. I'm predicting this is going to happen, and you can't see this coming, but I can. And the reason I could see it coming is because I had studied this field of persuasion, and I saw this Trump character, and he had the full tool set. And if you don't know what the tools are, you don't recognize them. And so I watched this monster come into our consciousness, and I was like in the dream, like, there's a monster, everybody, you don't know what's happening. You don't know what's going to happen. This is way bigger than you think. He's not going to go away in a month. He's not the crazy clown. No, it's a trick. He's going to be your president. Now, of course, I was considered like just a raving, you know, idiot for those times. To your credit, Reason was the first big outlet that took me seriously.
Well, cheers. So,
there you go. And, you know, put me on a video saying that he would win and why he would win with this set of tools.
Well, Ed, you talk about it in the book, and we'll dig into Trump specifically, but you talk about master persuaders. And these are people who are really good at getting the world to bend to their version of it. What are the characteristics of a master persuader?
So my ranking of persuaders are people like me are commercial persuaders, meaning I use it for my work. So I learn persuasion because it helps me write, it helps me cartoon, it helps me speak. You know, understanding how people's brains are wired helps you communicate in every way. Above me would be cognitive scientists, the people who have actually, you know, done the work, and they've seen more things than I've seen, and they know, if you use this burnt orange color on your interface, people are going to click on it 13% more often. I mean, they're at that level. And then above them, on my ranking, are what I call the master persuaders, who have the tools, you know, some combination of all those tools that, you know, the commercial and the cognitive scientists have. But they also have this big personality. There's something maybe about their situation. It could be an appetite for risk. Look at the amount of abuse that Donald Trump willingly took on. I mean, he knew that his background would be dug into. He knew he was going to be just savaged. And he did it anyway. And he doesn't even look like he's ever having a bad day. All right? That's not learnable in the easy way, right? So there's something about his personality, his risk profile, his bigger than life thing, the fact he's a billionaire that gives him that extra, you know, level of energy.
One of the, you know, it's interesting because, and in the book, I don't think you go into this, which, and I bring it up because it's interesting. A lot of people look at Trump and they say, you know, this is a guy, you know, the Stormy Daniels. And one of the things, and you do talk about this, where there's a kind of scandal fatigue, where if you go to sleep for more than 8 hours, you've missed three or four Trump mini scandals. So it's like Stormy Daniels, the porn star that he may have had some kind of affair with. But then folded into that was that she said that he asked to be spanked with a copy of Forbes magazine. And then there were like two or three other mini. I mean, it's just like you lose this. But people will say, well, he's a narcissist and he doesn't care. Like, he can't imagine a world in which he is not the center. Are narcissists better at being persuaders, at master persuaders, or are these totally different things?
Narcissists tend to be better at being leaders. Yeah. So there's a pretty high correlation between CEOs and leaders who are narcissists. And you know, I would argue that that's not the bad news that it sounds like, because especially if you have such a transparent job as the presidency, there is no world where he comes out okay by doing a bad job for the country. Right, he's locked in. He's got to make the country work, or it just doesn't work for his whatever narcissistic tendencies he might have.
Part of being a master persuader, and certainly in Trump, and I think this is the things that you were talking about that actually got Reason's attention first, were linguistic kill shots. Yeah. Define and give some examples of linguistic kill shots.
Well, these are his famous nicknames, right? Or which I've now started calling his forever names. You know, when you get your forever name, it isn't going away, folks. You know, you're Lion Ted forever. So the first one that caught my attention, of course, was Low Energy Jeb. Now, I would like to claim, I'm going to make this claim, and I'm pretty sure this would stand up to fact-checking, that I was the first person on the planet who said, that's the end of Jeb, that nickname is the end of him. Now, I don't think anybody else said that, right? It's only as time goes by, people realize how powerful that framing was. Because Jeb went from, in my mind, this calm, collected, executive kind of persona that I said to myself, man, in an emergency, you want that guy. He's not going to get, you know, he's unflappable and everything. But the moment you heard low energy, and he used another concept of contrast, because his own energy was so high, you could no longer see Jeb the same way. And it completely deflated his campaign. And this was the kind of tool that I saw early on, and said, oh, okay, you know, you don't see what's coming. This is way more powerful. And he had a little technique that he would use too, which is his nicknames were, you know, unusual words for politics. So anything that's unusual is a little stickier because, you know, like, oh, that's unusual. I'll remember that. Because we don't remember 99.99% of the things around us because our brains aren't big enough. You remember the exceptions. So he uses an exceptional kind of word that you don't see in politics. And then he builds it so it's designed for future confirmation. Every time you see Jeb, you go, yeah, compared to that Trump rally, that's a little low energy. And then he did it again with Lion Ted Cruz. Now, because Ted Cruz is a politician in a political race, somebody's going to accuse him of lying. So you know that it's going to get reinforced as you go. But the best part about it is that if you were going to cast a movie in which one of the characters was a huge liar, and Ted Cruz came in for, you know, to apply for the job, you'd say, take the sign off the door. We got this beady-eyed bastard. He looks like a liar from the get-go. So every time he said anything you thought wasn't necessarily true, and of course they're all doing that, you say, oh, Lion Ted. And of course he put it lion with an apostrophe. So he wanted to make sure that it's not just a nickname, it's a brand. Right? It's gonna stick. Likewise with Crooked Hillary, you knew there would be stories about the Clinton Foundation and emails and whatever, so that the crooked thing would be forever reinforced as he went. And you know, he does this, there's always a physical element. You know, do they look it? She looked kind of bent over a little bit, she looked a little crooked. And you see that consistently. There's the visual, there's the confirmation bias, there's the unique word. It's not an accident.
How does Trump get away with, you know, speaking of Ted Cruz, one of the, you know, when Trump forwarded, you know, kind of accounts or accusations that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the JFK assassination, which, you know, and when I think about it, like, that's one of the least bizarre and offensive things, right, that Trump said. How does he get away with that? Because that's nuts.
Because he's doing persuasion in a world where facts don't matter.
Yeah.
Now,
so you're all going to remember that title, subtitle.
So early on in the election, I was telling people, don't worry about the fact-checking. It's not going to hurt him at all because facts don't matter. We simply don't use them to make decisions. We just sort of think we do. It's an illusion. And that if he says something that makes you question the viability of somebody and it's not a fact, that feeling of unease stays with you, even if you say, well, it's not, obviously, you know, Ted Cruz's father was not part of this, but yeah, maybe, you know, there's always that little lingering thing. But beyond that, he also does continuous A-B testing. He's putting stuff out here in live rallies. He's seeing the immediate feedback. He's testing it with his staff. You know, they all say that. He's like running this by. What do you think of this? What do you think of this? And he's picking the winners. Now, the Ted Cruz dad thing wasn't a winner. You just put it out there, see how it performs. If other people had picked it up, if maybe the media on the right had made a big deal about it, it still wouldn't be true, but it would be getting a little more persuasive.
Talk about anchors as well as a tool of persuasion. And this is, you know, and this is something that it's kind of simultaneously hard to take Trump seriously the more he is part of our lives, or the bigger he gets. I mean, he's the president, but it's kind of hard to take him seriously. He is a master persuader in your parlance, but he's really good at negotiating. Anchors are part of that. Talk about anchors.
Yeah, so most of you know, if you're going to negotiate, you want to come in with a big first offer, so you have the most room to move back. But he also likes to make his anchors visual. So had he come in and said, well, I'm the one who's going to be strong on border security. We're going to have a very, you know, a good system, and we'll patch up the parts that need to be patched. You'd be like that in a minute. So he doesn't do that. He says, it's going to be a wall. And everybody says, it can't be a wall the whole way. You know, there's all kinds of different reasons why it can't be a wall. And then he looks at it and he goes, it's going to be a wall. Wall. It's a big, beautiful wall. Well, the people will climb over it. Just got 10 feet taller. It's a wall. Right? Now, exactly once I heard him say, well, you know, depending on the terrain and stuff like that, but he wisely just stopped doing that. Right? Now he's doing it because, you know, you sort of have to be talking about the details. But the visual of that was so powerful that he's moved the country from, well, that's a ridiculous idea, to, yeah, we might have a wall, you know, yeah, or at least some part of a wall.
Or we're talking about who's going to pay for it. It becomes a foregone conclusion, et cetera. And you talk, and this is also really interesting, is that he would say, okay, I'm going to get rid of 11 million people or 12 million people. I'm building a giant wall. Well, there'll be a door in it, and then we won't send everybody out. I mean, so you throw out that anchor kind of, it can be visual or argumentative, but it's kind of like saying, I want $50 million, and suddenly you feel like you're doing well if you're only giving them $5 million.
Yeah, when he was asked his net worth, and of course most of the experts are saying, well, it's probably between, you know, 3 and 5 billion, you know, generously. So he goes, 10 billion. And suddenly, a while goes by, and you sort of can't remember the other numbers, right? You know, and you might not believe it's 10, but if you were to ask people, like, after the fact, after months have gone by, you know, estimate Trump's net worth, you would notice that the average had started to get up closer to 10. You know, they'd be like, wow, it's not 10, but I'll bet it's 7. And they would have forgotten that the expert said it's probably closer to 3.
Now, part of, and, you know, this isn't what you're talking about in the book, because, for instance, are you in favor of his immigration policy, as he's talked about it, in its broadest terms, of stopping all, having legal immigration, getting rid of all illegal immigrants?
Well, I'm in favor of keeping the folks who have been living here as Americans, mm-hmm. Just on a human level,
right.
Forget the law.
So again, I mean, it's not like you actually want some of the policies that he does. I mean, some of the policies that he does or has articulated or even put into place are good from a reason perspective. So, I'm sure they are from yours as well.
Yeah, the other crazy thing I said early on is that you don't worry about this immigration stuff. These are his big first offers. He just wants to end up right of center. And as of today, basically, he's already said, I'll take your offer of keeping 800,000 people in the country and, well, just make it 1.8 million. He's actually keeping more people than their offer. All right. So that's moving pretty far, you know, to the middle. And of course, his base is screaming, but they're not going to leave him. All right? He's pretty clever about that. And then his idea of having more of a merit-based thing, it seems to me that no matter what system you had, whether it was lottery or merit-based, it's going to be racist in effect. You can't get away from it. Because even if you said, well, we'll just randomly do a lottery, you say, well, that's got to be fair, right? Except the only people applying for the lottery are people who have a certain amount of education. They know it exists. They could get to America. They, you know, so it ends up being, you know, more white people than people who have never heard of the lottery. So if you accept that every solution is racist in outcome, and he says, well, why don't we just take the people who will immediately contribute and will be a little selfish for America? All you're really arguing at that point is the value of selfishness for your nation. And he does a reasonably good framing of that, too, as he did in Davos. And he goes, I'm going to do what's good for America. You guys better be doing what's good for your countries. It's a friendly competition, right? Do as good as you can for your country. That's what we're doing.
So what are the you discussed this a bit, but what are the ethics of this type of persuasion? Or that's a separate issue.
So I fall into the trap of not talking about ethics, and then people say, oh, you're in favor of every unethical thing, which is not the case. I talk about persuasion as a tool, and tools don't have a good or a bad about them. They are just tools. If you are lying to somebody to save their own life, for example, I like to say, when people say, but you're forgetting the ethical considerations, I say, you know, I would lie to a terrorist to save your life. Would you do the same for me? You know, and people say, well, do the ends justify the means? To which I say, always, always. The ends justify the means, because everything you do is a cost-benefit analysis. Now, your opinion of what is justified may be completely different from mine, but everybody does what they think the ends will justify. So, you know, some of the argument is just sophistry.
To bounce back briefly to immigration, I'm an open borders type of person. I think that, and I realize not everybody will agree with me. I don't even agree with myself, you know, at least 3 days out of the week. But, you know, I think anybody who wants to come here who is not a criminal fleeing prosecution or has a communicable disease, and depending on what it is, you know, even that's not a deal killer, but they should be able to come here and work and live peacefully. What's a counter to Trump's bravura performance on immigration? Like, what would be, give me a master persuader counter story.
But I believe he would not, I don't know this, but I don't think he would limit the number of people who came in under a merit-based system, because, you know, we can use more software engineers, we can use more doctors.
Well, yeah, I mean, the GOP, and he's endorsed it, has come out with an official plan to, both in the Senate and the House, to cut legal immigration from about 1 million a year to 500,000. But I mean, is there a, you know, how do you counter somebody like Trump? Do you go toe to toe, or
counter for what
Trump,
purpose?
I guess to force him into a cognitive dissonance move. You know, I mean, like, you know, in the current climate, it seems like he's unstoppable because nobody is up to his level, but surely there must be ways to counter what he's doing.
It would depend on the topic. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to sort of dig down on the specific topic. But everything, pretty much everything, has a counter,
right,
one way or another. The immigration thing, most of us don't really understand the immigration like we don't understand most of the big topics. You know, very few people could sit down and detail all the ins and outs of immigration. And when you say, for example, he wants to cut it from 1 million to 500,000, I don't know the right number. Mm-hmm. How would I? You know, can we absorb that many people easily? If we can, I say 2 million.
Right.
But I don't know. Does anybody know? My guess is that cutting it from 1 million to 500,000 may have to do with they just assume that the merit will be kind of tough to, you know, it'll be a high bar to cross, I'm guessing.
In terms of the actual election, you don't vote.
Right.
Okay. But you did at various points towards Trump's critics would say, as America was going down the tubes, you endorsed in rapid succession, you endorsed Hillary Clinton, then you endorsed Trump. then you briefly endorsed Gary Johnson, you know, and then you went back to endorsing Trump. What was going on that explained that kind of quick domino?
Keep in mind that the endorsements were not my predictions. The prediction was Trump. The endorsements, originally I was not endorsing anybody. I was just writing about Trump. But because I wrote about him, people associated me with him. And they started calling me on social media Joseph Goebbels, you know, Hitler's PR guy. Now, given that people believed that Trump was actually going to be as bad as Hitler, like not in a, you know, not in a hyperbole way, but actually would do horrible things, putting me in that same sentence is marking me for death. And I mean that in an actual literal physical sense. Because let me tell you, if one of you were an actual Hitler and about to become, you know, leader of the country and do all kinds of Hitler stuff, and I had you in a room alone, I'd kill you. Right? Like, you know, I'd kill you, and I'd be pretty happy about it, too. So once people believed literally that the world was going to come apart if he got elected, and I would be part of that in their view, it was dangerous. And you saw in Northern California people getting attacked, leaving Trump rallies, et cetera. So I briefly used my own powers of persuasion to say, all right, I endorse Hillary Clinton. I'm sure Trump's going to win, but I endorse Hillary Clinton. Almost immediately, when, you know, that word started getting out, the critics just went away because they didn't care why I was on their team or even that it was not serious. But it still worked exactly as I imagined it would. But then toward the end, you know, I wanted to be on the winning team. And I said, all right, you know, she said something about estate taxes. She would tax me to the point that I considered confiscation.
But you couldn't afford to die.
I couldn't, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because you were...
Immortality wasn't my first choice.
Yeah.
But and so for that reason, so in my case, every dollar I made for the rest of my life, she would have taken 75 cents, right? Because half of it I pay when I make it, and then she would have taken another half from my estate. So I said, well, I can't live with that. So I endorsed Trump, but then that was right before the famous Access Hollywood tape dropped. And for about a week or two, I endorsed Gary Johnson just to find a safe space. My reasoning was that, you know, Gary Johnson only touches himself. And so... That felt like a safer place to be. And, you know, and he didn't know where Aleppo was, and he was a stoner. And I thought, well, I've got so much in common with him now. he's my guy. But toward the end, I fully embraced the Trump candidacy without embracing the politics.
Can you predict how the next 3 years are likely to play out? And also, you know, we have midterm elections coming up, which... people and political scientists are saying it's likely that the Democrats, just for structural reasons, will probably regain the House, probably not the Senate, et cetera. But, like, you know, what do you see happening? Can we, you know, I mean, at some point, do we just become tired of Trump and tune him out, or what?
Well, let me build up to that answer. So I had also predicted prior to inauguration that the following arc would play out in the first year. That they would start with marching in the streets, oh my God, we've elected Hitler, he's Hitler. But after a few months of not doing Hitler stuff, they'd start thinking, well, let's say something else about him. There's chaos in the White House, he's incompetent, his team is, you know, team is bad. And that sort of lasted through the summer. And this is exactly what I predicted a year before that happened. And then I said that by the end of the year, when they started doing the year-end reviews of, you know, what's happened, they will be forced to admit, and this is how I worded it, that he's effective even if you don't like what he's doing. So he got his judges, he's got the economy going, he cut the regulations, you watch TV, you've seen the whole list. By the end of the year, his resume was looking really good for the things he promised he would do, which is probably how you need to score it. So I nailed the first year. Which I don't think anybody else was saying anything along those lines. And I would say that in the next 3 years, I'm actually predicting what I'm calling a golden age. And I'm defining that as a point when everything is moving in the right direction. So I think we're going to have a strong economy. I think there's a non-zero chance that North Korea will lead to maybe a multiple, you know, a shared Nobel Prize. I think that's possible. It might be about the same time at the end of the year that Trump is being impeached, you know, if the Democrats get their way. But I think you've already seen ISIS defeated. You've seen, you know, between ISIS and the economy, and if North Korea gets under control, technology is doing wonderful things. I think it's a golden age. It might be the best. I think people are going to say it was the best time of their lives.
Well, you heard it here first. And we're going to hold you to that. We're going to come to the audience for Q&A in a minute. This, and I'm also remembering an interview you did with Virginia Postrel at Reason in the 90s, where you were talking about various things. How important do you think politics are to everyday life? You know, we're in the Bay Area. I've spent the past week and my colleagues, we were interviewing people who were doing fantastic things in technology. What is more important that drives progress and fairness and goodness in the world? Is it politics or is it technology or business or what?
Probably communication. Mm-hmm. The fact that anything good gets everywhere pretty quickly, and so you can share your ideas. In the marketplace of ideas, the good ideas can eat the bad ideas more efficiently than they could when you had to write a letter, you know. So I would say the communication ability we have is really drives everything.
Let me follow up on that. One of the things that is really fascinating, and I don't know how many of you are on Twitter regularly, but you do these. And this was one of the most remarkable things I saw that you were doing over the past few years, where you will do Periscope kind of interviews or transmissions, dispatches with your followers. You know, you'll get 30 or 40 or 50,000 people to watch you talking into the phone. And I saw one where I think you were on vacation in Switzerland or something,
yeah.
But you stopped to talk to your audience for like an hour or so. And about a year or so ago, I talked to an interactive media studies professor named Glenn Platt, who was talking about the intimacy economy, where new forms of communication are actually shrinking the gap between kind of the star or the author or the producer, or the great person up on the stage, the priest, and the audience. And Periscope seems to be doing that. Why did you start doing that? And what do you get out of it? And what does your audience get out of this? Because, I mean, it's really remarkable. And again, you know, apart from the content, it's the medium. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, so Periscope, if you don't know what it is, it's just you can just turn it on with an app and you can talk to anybody. You're the only one talking, but you can see their comments going by, so you can interact with them that way. It's the most intimate mass broadcasting thing because as I'm talking, people are simultaneously commenting and they're influencing me. So I like to think of it as being like this big collective mind, because I'll say, well, I think this might work, but I got this question. Does anybody know how this works? And the comment just scrolls by in real time. So my brain is like jacked in to 30,000 people at the same time. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of the focused center of that, but I have access to all of their intelligence in real time. But I'm also talking to just a screen, which is usually a picture of myself. They show you yourself instead of the audience because there's lots of them. And it's very personal. And people feel like they are actually talking to me in real time. And I, you know, have my coffee with them. And that's part of the hypnosis, by the way. It's branded coffee with Scott Adams. And I have them do a simultaneous sip. Because once they connect their love of coffee with this Periscope, it addicts them to it. And they do say that, by the way. It's the most common comment I get. So the reason I do it is I was looking for ways to extend my influence and what I was talking about, the election in particular, about Trump. And it was one of many things I just tried. I tried YouTube, I tried Twitter, I tried everything. But, you know, for every form of communication, there's a personality that fits it perfectly. And it turns out it just fit my personality perfectly. So that's why I use it. What I get from it is it's exciting. Every time I turn it on, I just love it. And the people I'm interacting with like it, and this is just great energy thing.
Final question, and then we're going to go to you guys for some questions. You end the book with a kind of curious anecdote about election night and the BBC. And you say that you had forgotten earlier, sometime before the election, you had promised the BBC that you would do an interview on election night when it became clear, you know, who was winning or losing. And, of course, England is ahead of us, so they were up and at it. And you said that you talked to the BBC after enjoying a large amount of California's finest medical marijuana. And my question for you is, are you still high?
Well, I'll tell you that the BBC doesn't ask me for interviews anymore. The part you left out is that, you know, it was this amazing night for me because I had predicted this event so well. And by the time I went to bed, high end of my mind, and then it's like after midnight and the phone rings, I'm like, I better see what that is. It's like, hello, it's the BBC. You'll be on in, you know, a moment. I'm like, perfect. Great. Let's do this. And I believe I said something, but I don't know what it was.
It's we're going to have to look that up and just see if it's like gibberish. Or, but
I think it was.
Okay, well, let's turn it over to questions. Melissa Mann is going to bring a microphone. And please, how about the gentleman right there, Bob? And wait until the mic comes to you.
I had two very short questions. One, you mentioned Peggy Noonan as a master persuader, and I thought maybe you could elaborate on that because that was struck me as very interesting. I read her as well. And the other was to ask you, what would Oprah be like in your 2020 election scenario?
Yeah. So, and we also have The Rock is in play as well, Dwayne Johnson.
All right, so Peggy Noonan, one of the best writers of politics ever, wrote for Reagan. I think she also wrote the Shining Hill on the, you know, Shining
City. She did the Boys of Pontoc, of the Normandy speech that Reagan gave, as well as the Thousand Points of Light that H.W. Bush. Yeah, very much.
So, and notice that they're visual. You know, she's a visual persuader, but you just look at her writing and it just, it's different. You know, she's just not like a normal writer. The question was Oprah?
Yeah.
Well, when that first came up, I said Oprah is too smart to do this, but she's also smart enough to make us think she might. Because, and I think her Golden Globe speech was along those lines. Now, maybe she was feeling it out as if, you know, if the country had risen as one and said, well, you know, we just proclaim you leader, maybe she would have done it. But I don't think that's where her heart is. And I think that Trump would rip her apart in that. It just wouldn't be a fair fight.
Hmm. We're going to come up right there. Yes, we'll get to you next.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Scott. Thank you. Two quick questions. One, way earlier tonight, you talked about marriage, and you talked about men not being happy. Is that because they're married to women? I'm married to a man, and I'm very happy. So maybe that's the issue.
You're obviously lying.
Second,
not about being married to a man, but about
second,
being happy.
No, I am. Yeah. Second, rhetoric. We talk about rhetoric, right? And rhetoric is just that. We don't care about rhetoric. We care about results. So are people going to, at the end of the day, you talk about the golden age, we care about the results. And is that what's going to get us to vote for Trump again?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like success to put people on your side. And I think if the economy stays strong and there are no new surprises, except for the Stormy Daniel type, which is really baked into the cake at this point, he's going to be hard to beat, assuming he wants to run. I've been saying that his sense of theater could drive him to do one amazing term, if it turned out to be amazing, and then leave on top. Because if you wait 8 years, something bad's going to happen that isn't your fault, right? There's going to be a war. There's going to be something that's going to be tagged on your legacy. So his sense of theater might get him out in four, plus his age. You know, he's mortal. He may know that's a factor.
Do you want to touch the marriage question there?
Well, I understand you said that you're married to a man and you're very happy. Was that the presumption?
17 years together.
Does he have a brother?
Two.
Okay.
Two. One is single.
My girlfriend is here, by the way.
Next question, Melissa. Where did you? Oh, yeah. Why don't we?
What subjects are you discussing on Periscope today?
It's almost always about some Trump persuasion-related thing. So immigration lately, you know that. So it's really whatever's the headline. And one of the things I can do with this, by the way, is because I'm a trained persuader, if I frame something first, it's really sticky. Hmm. And it's more because I'm first and because I have these tools. So as soon as I see a news story, I can be on Periscope within the hour framing it. And you'll see my frame sometimes, you know, on the news, and it's not a coincidence because most of the news producers and on-air talent follow my Periscope. So I can front run the news.
Next question. There you go.
Good question for you concerning Trump. If you were going to guess, or if you have an opinion about it, what percentage would you say that Trump uses in his master persuasion techniques, which is conscious, directed, logical, and what percentage is unconscious and just accidental and serendipitous?
So persuasion is a little like learning to type without looking at your fingers, meaning that when you start, you do have to think about it every time. It's like, oh, I'm going to make somebody think past the sale. I'm going to use a visual imagery. But at some point, it's automatic. So when people say, is it like just, you know, an instinct? Is he just, you know, a natural? Well, sort of somewhere in between. These are clearly skills he learned, and he wrote the book Art of the Deal. And when you see how often he makes you think past the sale, you know, we're going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it, right? The Mexico is going to pay for it is just to make you think there's going to be a wall and you're only talking about who's paying for it. But you see how often he does it. There's no way that it's, you know, accidental, but it's probably close to automatic because it's just something he knows how to do at this point.
Next, how about in the back there, sir? Ted?
Yeah, so Scott, to what extent has this conversation about politics displaced your work on Dilbert? Do you find this is your future, or are you trying to balance the two? You know, how do you think about it?
Well, I think my future about talking about this topic may be only as long as Trump's future, because he's what makes this fun. So I still do my full Dilbert thing as I always did. I just added this on top. So it's been a busy few years.
What before we go to the next question, let's focus on Dilbert for a second. You've been doing it now, I mean, since 89, or it was first published in 89. How do you maintain that? That's a long haul.
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is it's still easier than all of your jobs. Right. So,
but it doesn't pay as well.
I made a promise to myself that when Dilbert started working, that I would never complain about, oh, I've got to draw a cartoon. My work is so hard. When, you know, there's somebody at the smelting plant, you know, doing that. Yeah. So first of all, it's easy, and second of all, nothing's easy if you do a lot of it, right? You can get pretty sick of it, but it's always a new topic. So there's never a Dilbert that's exactly like the one I did last
time. What do you think of people like, I guess, Burke Breathed or Gary Larson? I mean, these are, or Cal, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes. These are
quitters?
Strips that...
Quitters.
Okay, yeah. Well, then I guess I do. What are you offended by them, or should they drive whatever train they're on, you know, like into the ocean no matter what? Or
I don't understand them. Yeah. Let's say this. So, you know, Waterson, for example, mm-hmm. quit because the job was really hard the way he did it, because he used like a little tiny paintbrush and it was just a whole bad process. I do it on a computer, cut and paste. And But he did it because he thought his artistic, you know, arc had hit its, you know, zenith, and he was going to, you know, go out before it became sad. And I thought to myself, you're doing this for other people. They still want to see it. Like, you know, why can't you sell people things they want? Hmm. You know, I didn't understand the selfishness of it, I guess.
That's an interesting inversion. Yes.
Assuming a decent economy the next 3 years, which Democrat has the best chance of beating Trump and why, if you were going to make a prediction? And separately, is there any Democrat out there that you would call the Trump Democrat, meaning they have that power of persuasion?
Fast answer is nope. There's nobody at a sort of a national consciousness level that even comes close. If George Clooney could escape his Hollywood situation, which he can't, right? There's probably just too much stuff there to do it. He actually has the skill. If you listen to a George Clooney interview where he's talking about politics, you're going to see some master persuader stuff. And I don't know where he came by it, but it's pretty palpable to people who know this stuff. So he could do it if he hadn't had the Hollywood stuff. But maybe even that's not enough to stop.
When you say the Hollywood stuff, what do you mean? Just like his obligations and things like
that? No, I mean, by the time the opposition research people got into him, you know, they'd find 50 examples of Me Too.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it doesn't hurt Trump because he came to us saying, I'm no angel, literally with those words. I'm no angel. I'm bringing a certain set of skills to you. Hmm. You know, this is my package. But if you do the hypocritical path, you're just doomed. So, but no, there's nobody obvious that has charisma.
Are there any Republicans? Because, you know, there's a large group of Republicans who are kind of, you know, anti-Trump or never Trumpers.
Not really. Yeah. You know, part of it is he breaks the curve so badly. You know, if you hold him in your mind, everybody else just disappears. You know, I talk in the book about how Pence was a brilliant choice because you want a vice president who seems qualified. Pence has, you know, on paper, all the qualifications, but he looks like the washed down version of the main person. You know, if you took everything that's interesting away from Trump, you'd have Pence, which is just that's like a perfect choice because he's like just the spare tire. It's like, all right.
The harshness and actually funniness of that comment reminded me of another point that you make in the book, and this is something that we share in that we're both from New York. I was born in Brooklyn. Scott was born and raised in upstate New York, and you talk about Trump. Trump is, first off, is very funny, which very few people, especially people who dislike him, give him credit for. But he also has a very New York sense of humor, as opposed to a California sense of humor. And discuss a little bit about that. And how does that play? You know, you talk about New York, California, but then there's also Texas, which is this other third kind of point of cultural significance.
Yeah, I can't speak as well to Texas, but I've been in New York and I've been in California, and there's a big difference about what people think is funny. A New York sense of humor, and of course this is a gross generalization, doesn't apply to every person, is there's something funny about saying something that's terrible. So if you remember Trump's comment about McCain, and you know, he said, McCain's a war hero, and Trump said, well, I prefer the ones who didn't get caught. Yeah. Now, first of all, he's using the 2 of 6 rule of humor, which is you need, without getting into it, you need two dimensions before something registers as funny. And two of the dimensions are something, you know, naughty or awful, which, you know, that comment was, and the other is clever. You know, there are a few other dimensions. But he combined those two things in a classic joke form, and then realized, probably after the fact, people don't get this as a joke. It's not, and people said that he's being disrespectful to McCain. But if you're from New York, you understand that to be opposite of what was happening. The reason it was funny is because you don't make fun of veterans. And you certainly don't make fun of a POW who, you know, served his country and everything else. So because it was so awful, that's why it was a joke. And, you know, of course, he could also get away with it because he was good for veterans and stuff. But if you thought that was just disrespectful, you've missed the show. You know, it's a pretty good show if you know that he's joking.
So what, I mean, is the country divided between kind of New York and California sensibilities, or then what happens to, there's the Midwest where a lot of people live, and there's Texas, which seems to be something else. How does that kind of factor in?
Well, having not lived in too many places, right. I would imagine that the Midwest puts more of a premium on being nice,
right.
And that probably works against him a little bit, but not enough to prevent him from winning just about every state in the middle.
Yeah, including a couple or several Democratic strongholds that Hillary didn't even campaign in. She took like Wisconsin.
Right.
Let's have another question.
I think you've got time for one more, Nick.
Okay, great. Well, this will be it.
At the beginning of the night, you talked about how you were left of the left, but then you talked about how you thought Trump might usher in a new golden era. So I'm having kind of trouble understanding that, and I had a pretty straight question. Do you think Trump's policies are good for America?
Well, let's look at his policy for ISIS. That seemed to be good. His economic policies seem to be working. His immigration policy, if he gets what he wants, we still get lots of immigrants, but they're the kind that can contribute more easily. So it's good for America while being bad for the people who didn't get to come here, maybe bad for the countries that we drain their talent from. I would say that he promised us a selfish approach, America first. And I don't know how you could argue that he's, you can't argue that he's not delivering that, could you?
Yeah, but is it good? Regardless of what he promised, do you like what he promised, and do you want to see him deliver what he promised?
What would be an example of something that's not good? The economy is good. Oh, give me an example. What
Tariffs. The tariffs are a terrible idea. And he's put a tariff on solar panels and on washing machines.
I would argue that if you're looking at it from an economic perspective, you probably have a good argument there. But this is a persuasion game. And his persuasion game is second to none, and we don't know how that's going to play out. So the mere fact that he can threaten some companies with a trade war makes other companies say, well, maybe we won't reach so far. You know, so it has a dampening effect on a lot of places. I don't think he can do a straight economic analysis of that. So, but I would put that in the category of things, I'm not an expert on that. So it would be hard for me to have an opinion on whether those... the tariffs are a good or bad idea.
What about the social issues then? Because he's come out as very anti-abortion or reproductive rights. He seems to kind of play footsie with alt-right kind of racist elements. Does that sit well with you as an extreme liberal?
Well, the second one, the alt-right stuff, is more about the politics. That's not really a policy. Mm-hmm. So the question was about policy. Mm-hmm. There's no question he's offended a huge swath of the country. We're very unhappy about living here. I don't diminish that at all. And indeed, I'm making it a personal effort to try to fix that. So I'm doing a number of things behind the scenes to directly address that.
Will there be a Dilbert story arc about abortion?
Probably not. But let me clarify there. President Trump just wants the federal government not to be in the business of deciding. That would leave it to the states. And if this situation had happened 30 years ago, maybe some of the states, given their way, would make it illegal. But I think today they'd have a tough time attracting industry to their state if they made that illegal. So I think the practical impact of his personal opinion about abortion, we may never see it.
And same with drug legalization, where during the campaign, he actually said the state should decide it, which Jeff Sessions, his attorney general, has kind of argued with him about that. But it's
they're not going after it.
Right.
So there may be a persuasion play here that hasn't unfolded yet. Because sometimes you have to break something before you can fix it. And nothing would break the marijuana situation harder than Jeff Sessions coming after somebody in California and closing down a dispensary for not a good reason other than it's illegal, the world would blow up. So he may be trying to break something. Don't know yet.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much, Scott Adams.
Thank you.
The book is Win Bigly. Check it out.
Thank you.